Our next guest is not to be confused with the creator of Calvin and Hobbes. He is the filmmaker Bill Watterson. He's a technophobe. It was 2001 before he even considered getting a pager. And he says that he never really caught up, which is perhaps the cause or the result of his deep appreciation for tactile things.
I just think there's no substitute for something you can hold in your hand, something tactile. I don't even like online shopping. To hold something in my hands and be like, wait, do I really want this? But there's just no substitute for that. And I think it really charged me up as a kid whenever I would see anything Harryhausen, Clash of the Titans, even all the way back to the old King Kong, all the things you'd expect from a kid who grew up in the 80s. Anytime there was a creature or a monster that was in that stop motion or miniature or puppet vein, you just felt like you could touch it and have it, and it could be a toy that you could play with, or it was real in a way that just made every movie so exciting.
What he's saying makes perfect sense if you consider his new movie. It's called Dave Made a Maze, and it's the opening night feature of the Atlanta Film Festival. As the title suggests, the movie is about a guy named Dave who made a maze. All of the intricate sets are made completely out of cardboard. Our producer, Gabby Watt, spoke with Bill by Skype about the film. Here's that conversation.
So Dave Made a Maze is the opening film at the Atlanta Film Festival, which is very exciting. Could you tell me a little bit about the premise of the film for the people who haven't seen it?
Absolutely. It's I'm always tempted to go into the deep themes and how wonderful and emotional it is, but at its core, it's a movie about a frustrated artist who builds a cardboard box fort in his living room, and his girlfriend comes home from a weekend away and to discover that he's trapped inside, and she organizes this band of oddballs to go in after him. And when they get inside, they realize it is a huge fantasy world made entirely of cardboard, and it is one that is very dangerous and very deadly. So they've all got to work together and figure out how to get out alive.
Why did you specifically want to set this story inside of a maze?
It's interesting. It actually came from a true story that I told my co-writer, and he ran with it. I had built my own fort with John Richards back home in Cleveland, this beautiful pillow and sheet fort. And we were headed to his house for dinner. I left a note. Hey, Mom, going to John Richards. Be back later tonight. She doesn't see the note, comes home, is calling my name, doesn't hear me respond, opens the door to my room, and lo and behold, here is this amazing labyrinth of pillows. And she panics and assumes somehow that I've been trapped or lost within it. So she just tears it apart looking for me, which is just wonderful mom logic. But Stephen Sears, my co-writer, heard that idea of how crazy it would be if you could be trapped in a single room. You're in the room, but you're completely inaccessible because you're also somewhere else. And that was the genesis of the script. And then once it started getting on the page and we started going back and forth, it was just irresistible to look at the maze as a metaphor for basically the creative process and how trapped, you know, when you're frustrated and you're trying to get something done, not necessarily, you don't have to be a screenwriter or a musician or anything that grand. When you're trying to get anything done, you can get so trapped in your own head, so frustrated. It looks like, you know, you can never find your way out. You just keep spiraling further and further down. I mean, you could look at it as a metaphor for addiction, depression, any of those things. And then the things that are part of you, that are essential parts of you, also have a way of harming the people that are close to you. So that's why the maze has pitfalls and booby traps and manifestation of all the darkest sides of the artist. The anger, the way you can lash out, the way you can be self-destructive and destructive to others. It started out just as a box fort, but it was the perfect metaphor for the bigger themes that we ended up tapping into.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the sets, because it almost seems that the movie is, you know, set first. There's its incredible set design. How did you get all the cardboard?
We, interestingly enough, didn't pay a dollar for any of the cardboard in the film. It's wonderful. We reached out to, it started actually specifically with American Apparel. We reached out to them for the spindles that you end up seeing in one of the scenes as a bed of spikes. And they were just so generous. They just opened up the warehouse and said, we've got all this stuff if you need it. And it was rows and rows of neatly stacked pallets of cardboard. And we filled a whole cube truck with it. And then we also had personal donations. Friends were stashing stuff for, you know, in the months leading up, we put group emails out like, hey, friends, if you could just hold on to any recyclable cardboard and any of that for us, we'll come by with a truck. And we pulled up to the shooting location, which is a small warehouse in Glendale, California, thinking we were set for life. And we ran out, I don't know, 3-4 days into production. So we were lucky enough that our neighbors at the shoot space, Solar City, had a designated cardboard dumpster, and they were perfectly happy with us raiding it every morning. So every couple days, you know, the producer and a few PAs would go out there, hop in the dumpster, raid it, and show the art department what they'd found, and that's what the next room would be built out of.
That's awesome. So were you building sort of day by day, and then that sort of dictated parts of the story?
Not necessarily parts of the story. We were building every day, including the very last day. We had 20 days of principal photography on the stage in Glendale, and right up to and including that 20th day, we were building. Some of the look was determined by what we found. For example, there's one of my favorite rooms. We call it the Kubrick Corridor. It also looks like a hallway from Empire Strikes Back, but it's an octagonal corridor of cardboard with perfect circles cut into all the cardboard and these shafts of light, and they have this very sort of intimate personal moment between the two leads. That was a palette of cardboard that we saw at American Apparel. And I was, oh man, it's got holes in it. You know what? Bring it anyway. And then once we had it in a space, we started looking at it and like, I bet that would look amazing as its own hallway. Let's take advantage of the fact that it has these crazy holes in it. So that corridor only existed because of the materials that we had on hand. And then we just really tightly scheduled the movie, and we only had room for maybe two sets at a time. So whatever we were about to shoot on was being built while we were shooting on the set previous. So if you look at any of the dailies, the second I call cut, it's just a cacophony of buzzsaws and hammers and screw guns as they try, you know, frantically build the next set we're about to shoot on. And then there's a sequence at the end, a big montage sequence of all the sets crumbling and being destroyed. And the setup was basically, set was being built in the morning, bring in the actors, block the scene, send them to hair and makeup, finish building the set and lighting it, bring the actors back, shoot the set, wrap the actors, film the destruction of the set. And we did that every day.
Were you intentional in kind of wanting to make this a cult classic?
I all of my favorite movies are cult classics. I would never say this to a distributor or to my agents or anything like that, but all of my favorite movies bombed at the box office and then became cult classics. I didn't set out to have that happen to this movie. We put everything into this movie and want every bit of success. We want everyone to see it. But we definitely knew we were making a strange film. I knew I was not making a movie for everybody, but I knew that the people we were making the movie for would be obsessed with it the way that we were about the things that we loved. And we tried to be careful. I don't love parody, and I don't love, you know, pastiche. I was more looking for homage. Like I would be very proud if you would watch this movie and name five movies. You should be able to watch this movie and say, I can name five movies that director loves. And I can almost guarantee you'll be right. I wasn't going for nostalgia, the way Stranger Things just keeps showing, you know, the Stranger Things on Netflix just keeps showing you things that you would have loved if you were a kid at that age. And it's satisfying and it's great. It's nice to see all those things. But we didn't want to just push buttons. We wanted to make a movie that made us feel like those movies made us feel, because we haven't felt like that in a long time. And of course, part of it is because we've gotten older and gotten married and had kids and all these things. But part of it is that blend of creativity, madness, spontaneity. I don't feel like I see it a lot. And to do it without being didactic about it, or to do it without being heavy-handed, to still have that sense of fun and wonder and not knowing what's coming around the next corner. I don't know, I miss that. I don't feel like that a lot when I go to the movies. And we wanted to have everyone, you know, feel good like that again.
Filmmaker Bill Watterson, the director of Dave Made a Maze. That's the opening night feature of the Atlanta Film Festival, which kicks off this Friday at the Plaza Theater. You're listening to City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.